Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here today with Chad Montrett. Chad is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's the author of four books, including A People's History of Environmentalism in the United States, and Making a Living, Work, and Environment in the United States. And his new book from 2018 is what we're going to be speaking about today, The Myth of Silent Spring, Rethinking the Origins of American Environmentalism. Well, Chad, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And would you just start by by explaining the overview of your book?
So the book is really based on the work that I've been doing all the way up to this point. I, like everybody else, wrote a dissertation that was a very specific case study of opposition to strip mining in Appalachia. And that really was a project that I wanted to try out because I was interested in how to bring labor and environmental history together. And that just so happened to be a good case for that. But as I was, you know, settling into my job and doing more research and writing more things, I just became, I think, more clear about how I could do kind of a general overview of that in terms of how to make race and class figure in the way we tell the story of the origins of environmentalism. So that's what the book does. And there's a couple different ways it does that. But I mean, it's I think generally meant to sort of at least raise serious questions, if not also make an effective challenge to the idea that the environmental movement started in 1962 with the publication of Silent Spring. And so the book's title is maybe a little bit maybe some people sort of are put off by it, but I'm not saying that the book itself is mythological, but rather what historians and lay people did with it by trying to make it figure as the starting point for environmentalism is not the case, and that we need to see that larger history, not only because we just want to get history right, but also because how we imagine or envision and write the history of environmentalism also has to do with how we think about it now, the present time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I found really interesting about the book and the kind of way that you structure it is that, you know, Rachel Carson has kind of become a beloved figure. In part, you know, Silent Spring, you know, is a great book. Obviously, it made a big difference. And also, frankly, that there's not a lot of women so often that are centered in a lot of our history still, and so it's a challenge, right, to take on this icon. And so, why is it so important to not take on Rachel Carson, but to decenter Rachel Carson from our narrative in as historians, but also in the public as the kind of creator of environmentalism? Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the ways that the book is problematic, the book Silent Spring, is her blindness to class and race. And so when she's trying to investigate and apply some kind of scientific, you know, critical thinking to the use of pesticides, she's missing those as factors in the way that pesticides are used and in terms of their effects on people. And so I think that's a legitimate criticism of the book. And then what happens, though, too, I think, is because the book became such an important sort of bookend or bookmark for the beginning of the movement, that the people that were telling the story of environmentalism later and the people that were becoming environmental activists also kind of became, they just sort of adopted the blindness to class and race as well. And so, sort of getting past that also is critical to sort of decentering the book itself is critical for us as historians to rethink the origin story and for environmentalists to think about what environmental movement might look like.
Yeah, and I want to touch on all of those issues. I mean, those are all really important. I guess, you know, in kind of because, you know, people like to have starting points for movements and things like this, how should we, in terms of time, and periodization, how should we think about the environmental movement? How do you, you know, if you're thinking about the origins of American environmentalism, what are some of the stories that you think are at the beginning of this larger narrative?
Well, I mean, I suppose if somebody really wanted to take me to task, they could say that even I have a narrow perspective because I really look at only two or three centuries. And you could say, you know, we could go back way beyond that and talk about what people do to adjust or accommodate to environmental problems. But I would argue that the environmental movement that we think about, and even though the term environmentalist isn't invented till later, is a response to industrial capitalism. So we start with the beginnings of that economic system that's based on manufacturing. And then part of why I wrote this book is because I'm actually at a university in New England, in fact, in Lowell, which is the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. And I have been going through the archives there and looking at what workers are doing in response to the water pollution in particular, but later on also air pollution, and also what the state government is doing. And they're doing things already in the 19th century that look like environmentalism, right? And so that's what I would say is we really should start it with the thing that's at the center of the environmental problems that we're facing even into the 21st century. And that's industrial capitalism, and that means shifting the prioritization.
So if we start with, you were mentioning in your last answer that, you know, starting with industrial capitalism, and the article that you wrote several years ago on Lowell and the mill girls and the way that they became environmentalists of a sort, which you center on in this book as well, is something I've been teaching for a long time, ever really since it came out. I always thought that was a really telling moment in terms of people sort of entering into a factory and all of a sudden realizing in nature in an entirely new way. And I think that it really transforms our understanding of nature. And I think that the myth of Silent Spring really brings that into a popular audience quite a bit. Could you talk about some of the other stories that you focus on here that add to our overall narrative of environmentalism?
As I'm sort of wrapping up with the 19th century story and moving into the 20th century, one of the things I look at is what working class people are experiencing, at that point in time, not only in factories, but also in their neighborhoods. And so, you know, how, say, you know, living in the 19th ward around, the Hull House, or living down in Packingtown, gets many native born as well as immigrant working class people, they're sort of forced into thinking about the kind of environmental hazards that they're facing. They can't ignore them, right? They're there in their daily lives. And then when they go into the meat, packing, facilities, or they go into other industrial manufacturing, facilities to work, then they're finding there too, the environmental problems. And there's different ways that they go about sort of kind of try to incorporate them into their interests as working people. Sometimes it might be through their union. Sometimes it's through, social. Middle class sort of social welfare kind of organizing like settlements. Sometimes it's through the workplace health and safety movement, which is getting started at the same time. There's other examples like the auto workers who are in Michigan. Many of them are migrating from rural areas and farm work to these urban places in Michigan and doing auto production or something tied to auto production. And their life changes, right? Their relationship to nature changes. And initially, they're members of like sportsmen's clubs because they like to hunt and fish. That's a way that they can kind of feel reconnected to nature as they've left the rural areas. And those sportsmen's clubs turn into environmental groups. And by the 1940s, they're using them to lobby for water pollution control legislation. And then their union, the United Auto Workers, becomes one of the leading voices for environmental reform, at least, in the United States. And that's very counterintuitive, right, to the way we think about the environmental movement, that Walter Ruber, the president of the UAW, would be one of the key figures in the rise of an environmental sensibility and political work around that environmental sensibility. We do the United Food Farm Workers movement, which I think of also needs to be put back in, it needs to be incorporated into the narrative about environmentalism's origins, because they're doing this interesting thing that's very much like environmental justice, right? They have an ethnic identity, they have a class experience, and they're facing environmental problems, and so they think of environmental problems as part of their struggle for justice. And I guess what a lot of this points to is how important work is to to the way that people think about nature, to the environmental problems they experience, and to how they get organized or organize themselves to deal with those problems. And that's not in Silent Spring. And it's not in a lot of the environmental organizations that were influenced or even sort of established in the wake of Silent Spring. Those environmental groups, you know, they do a lot of good work, but that's not their focus, right? And so those are the ones, I guess those groups, along with other historians, are the ones who get to tell the story. And they just told the story about themselves, basically. They're very sort of myopic in what they thought had happened, because they could only think about it in their own terms. And some of that has to do with the way they think about who can be environmentalists, right? And that's part of the problem here too, is like complicating this idea that can you only talk about civil rights activism, or can you only talk about labor union organizing, or can you only talk about environmental activism? Because a lot of people don't see themselves as sort of separated in that way in time. It's only later that people come in and detangle them from that, right? So like when, you know, the people are fighting to deal with lead paint in East St. Louis, they're doing it as civil rights activists, you could say, but that's an environmental, you know, campaign.
Why do you think that's happened? I mean, why do you think there's been such a disconnect in recent decades, I guess, that has sort of marked out environmentalism as this thing that mostly upper middle class and upper class white people do, that's about preservation and the charismatic species and et cetera, where those stories of, say, you know, fighting lead or fighting for, working class hunting, working class areas that are good for hunting and fishing and keeping them preserved and things like that gets sort of talked about in some other way.
Well, I mean, to kind of maybe go back to the, I think where you started, if I wanted to be, you know, give the people that sort of created this mythology, you know, the most benefit of the doubt, or to try to understand where they were doing, like, it's just easy to think of like a book as starting the movement, right? This thing that gets, you know, published in a particular year. And then you see a lot of, you know, a flurry of conversation and activity happening. And you just sort of gets sort of drawn to that as the story. And then there's all these, you know, other things that happen, like Earth Day, which are very, you know, public and, you know, easy to see. They're obvious and then they look big. So maybe there's just that. I mean, I think I'm still not really sure that, as I, you know, when I did the book, and even since then, I ponder this question, and I'm not sure. I mean, another possibility is that there's, you know, this is actually evidence of the racism and the disregard for working class, working class people's experience. And that could be maybe just, you know, the way that I think Rachel Carson did it. I don't think she was intentionally trying to exclude people of color from her book, or trying to exclude working class people, but she did. And that's something to do about a white middle class person's way of thinking about the world. And there are people that are intentionally trying not to have those people be part of the story. And, you know, a lot of the suburbanization that's happening in the 1960s is very intentional effort on the part of white people to leave cities, not only because they want to leave what's there in terms of problems, but to leave African-American people, to leave poor white people, to leave immigrants behind and live in this, you know, this contained white middle-class universe that, you know, has big yards and there's, you know, a lot of ability for them to just quietly, like, sort of nurse their racism and not have to really fight about it so much the way they would if they're back in the city and there's more proximity. And so those people, I mean, those people are supposedly the ones who start the environmental movement, that they're the ones who are getting drawn into the, you know, the new groups. So I don't know. I can't say that those answers are conclusive in any way, but I think I can only speculate about it. I mean, I don't know if you have ideas about that or other people do. I would like to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really interesting to hear you talk in this way, because the ways, you know, we talk about, especially, of course, environmental historians tend to be very pro-environmentalism as a general rule. And we talk about it sometimes as an almost heroic narrative of these, you know, enormous battles and, you know, against corporations and things of this nature, forcing the government to do this and that. But You know, as you point out, like the you know, there's also this large literature for those of you who are not environmental historians listening to this. There's a large literature on how environmentalism comes out of the suburbs, and okay, that's not inaccurate, but it also, you know, we're creating a kind of valorization of a movement that is generated in itself by white supremacy and racism in terms of keeping, you know, keeping people out. And I think, and I don't know how you feel about this, and this is a little inside baseball perhaps, but, you know, one of the frustrations I've had over the years with the field of environmental history is the fact that, you know, a lot of things like race, class, and gender are sort of secondary. And that, you know, it feels to me like a lot of the work that's being done is people who are, you know, they grew up in a suburban household, they got interested in the environment. Now they're, you know, 50 or 60 or whatever, and they're really into rock climbing, so they write about rock climbing, or they're really into rafting, so they write about rafting. And it kind of perpetuates this. And there's a, and to me, like, I look at environmental sociology, for instance, which is very heavily engaged in environmental justice issues. And then, and there's, of course, a huge environmental justice literature, you know, around the academy. But then I look at the field of environmental history, and it seems really disconnected from the way, from all of this. And I don't know how you feel about that.
I agree, but I was a little more frustrated sort of 4 or 5 years ago. And I was thinking, like, I'm done with environmental history as a field. And then I decided, like, this editor at California just, you know, asked me, do you want to write, you know, like a final book? And so I did, but I was ready. I really, and I think I am leaving the field anyway, just because I've reached sort of the end of a narrative arc for the work that I'm doing. But yeah, I mean, it was just really, I just kept seeing again and again that we're just, like, you know, speaking out into the dark or whatever, and like nobody really seemed to be interested in actually changing the narrative. I don't think that's as true anymore, though. I'm really encouraged, like, if I'm going to leave the field now, I'm encouraged there are people like you and many, many other historians who I meet at conferences who are doing something different. I don't know how much of an impact we're making, though. There's still like this cadre of historians that are doing what you say, and when they talk about environmentalism, ignoring all of the work that we're doing. Like they just don't see, you know, they have these, like, you know, blinders on too that allowing them to disregard what we're doing. It's very interesting. I think to some extent it might have to do with the origins of the field, which was really, at least for a lot of Americanists, you know, it comes out of intellectual history and the history of the West. And those tend to deal with elites and rather than, like, you know, the new social and labor history of the 1960s. And that's who trained me, right? When I think that was true of you, but I went to college and got taught history by somebody who came out of University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was an SDS, who was doing civil rights activism, right? And that's how he thought about environmentalism. He was also a labor historian, and that's where I want to thought about marrying the two. That's not the typical description of it, I think, the early environmental historians, right? That's not who those people were who founded the ASEH and the professional journals and that.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely correct. And you know, you see the kind of generations that come and go now it feels getting older. And yeah, I think it's definitely reflecting that. But to kind of move this in our last here 10 minutes or so, to a broader topic. I mean, I think that what we're talking about in terms of the field of environmental history and the way that our work kind of fits into that or doesn't is to some extent reflected in the larger questions of environmentalism in America and who's considered an environmentalist and who isn't. And I think that, you know, your work centers race and class so much in environmentalism, and yet, you know, state your story of the UAW or my work on the International Woodworkers of America, really says no, like, look, they're these working class environmentalists. And yet people are shocked thinking, you know, today that workers and environmentalists are inherently opposed to each other. And, you know, you look at some labor unions that are pretty anti-environmentalist, like, say, the laborers today, and it kind of reinforces this narrative that's very strong in the environmental movement. And so I was wondering, in terms of the political impact of your work, what are the stories that those of us who are interested in environmentalism need to learn about that relationship between work and the environment, both in the past and in the present?
Well, I mean, let me start with a general observation in that respect. I think understanding this, like actually just recovering the history, first of all, and then understanding it is important, because the way we think of workers and environmentalists as being separate right now is not an accident. And there's two main ways, very intentionally try to split them apart and to disentangle them. And you know, it's like, you know, they don't have complete control over who creates the story we tell about things. But they have a lot of economic power, and increasingly in the 1970s with deindustrialization and other economic problems, they can manipulate workers and put them in this position of having to choose when before they weren't choosing. And so if we look at the history all the way up, even into present time, really, there are still examples of workers deciding they're not going to choose, that they're going to do both things. The other problem is that we have to put some responsibility on environmental groups. They needed to, and they still need, to create the conditions for workers to be able to be environmentalists, right? And so if the environmental groups aren't out there trying to also get past, you know, a jobs bill, so that if United Mine Workers members lose their jobs because we're gonna go away from coal, then they shouldn't be surprised when coal miners don't necessarily align with them, when they don't necessarily feel like that they can work with them. The reason why so many miners were involved in opposition to strip mining in Appalachia in the 1960s is because many of them were deep miners still at that point, and they saw strip mining as a thing that takes away their jobs, which is what it was. It's a mechanization. It's a way of mechanizing mining even further. And also they saw the environmental problems, but they could see those environmental problems because they were also seeing what they were doing in opposition to strip mining as protecting their jobs at the same time, right? That they weren't being organizing themselves out of a job. So, you know, there are a lot of possibilities for this. And I don't know where the social forces will come from to get environmental groups to turn in that direction, but that does need to happen. I mean, I think, as you're probably aware, like the Green New Deal is a very interesting concept, because of course the first New Deal was green, right? There's a green component to it, very intentionally bringing establishing programs that would not only solve economic problems, but solve environmental problems at the same time. So that's promising. And maybe, you know, AOC and Markey and other people are going to help us move that forward. I mean, that is what has to happen, I think, for us to create an environmental movement that's viable, sustainable, and really does address the problems that we're facing. We have to really broaden and expand it and deepen it. And the history is important to that. Have a story that helps us see that as a possibility. Is critical.
I mean, I guess to kind of close this out, you know, we're facing, I mean, just thinking about it, things in terms of climate change, right? And trying to create a climate movement, you know, it's a difficult movement in a lot of ways, because it's not an immediate day-to-day thing. You know, seasons come and go, and, you know, the world's warming, but it doesn't seem to everybody to be immediate. But of course, you know, the long-term implications of climate change are going to hit working communities and communities of color much harder than relatively wealthy whites. Relatively wealthy whites make up a lot of the environmental movement's membership and certainly leadership. And so, you know, what would you say to if there are climate activists and environmentalists listening to this right now, what would you say to them in terms of how to build a movement that centers the working people who are going to be needed, not only because it's going to impact them, but for the political movement that's going to be required to get the kind of legislation passed to actually fight climate change?
I mean, that's a huge question. I mean, this is where I feel like I stumble in interviews, because it's like, I mean, I think I have some ideas, but I'm really not an expert in that sense. I guess as an historian, I mean, there are obvious things like, you know, grassroots organizing is very important, but so is listening to the many constituencies involved. You know, like when I was involved in the Mountain Justice campaign in Appalachia, you know, because I wrote a book about activism, you know, that was centered on strip mining, when the activists were doing a lot of nonviolence, civil disobedience, and other kind of community organizing in the early 2000s. I went down there, and they were listening to people in the community, right? They weren't just coming down and or, you know, if they were actually from those areas, just sort of assuming that they knew what the answer was, which is not to say that, you know, I think we should like not stand aligned on the idea that climate change is real, but there are ways in which that this is very complicated. And like what I was saying, like, what if, you know, and this may have seemed utopian at the time, but it's not anymore. What if we had said, well, let's have a government-funded wind turbine, you know, production program happen in Appalachia, and all the people that are going to lose their jobs because we're going to get away from fossil fuels get first priority, just like we give veterans, you know, first priority on jobs to go work in those. And they have to be unionized, and they have to be, or at least union scale, the way we did during World War II with war production. I mean, we don't have to invent the wheel for this. We have to think creatively, but there are a lot of answers in the past for us if we look. In the past.
Yeah, and I think that's a point that I'm trying to make a lot these days, is that you know, we're in this moment where it seems like things are terrible, and that there's all of this you know, there's no hope. Sometimes you get this from students and things like this, but that in fact, not only the past, but the relatively recent past has a lot of political possibilities that are just forgotten about today.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, part of what's happened, part of why us are separated too is that many of us, even though like I was involved in, you know, labor organizing, and some people also have been, and we tried to like steer labor unions, organize labor in a different progressive direction. But you know, I mean, we're basically at the lowest union density in history since the 1930s. It's probably what, under 7% or something for the private sector. And that also is like, that's what's hampering, you know, a sort of thinking about this in terms of economic and environmental problems at the same time. And maybe that's another thing we need to really do. And I think that your work really speaks to too, is like to think about how important it is to have a vibrant union movement, a vibrant labor, organized labor movement.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should probably let you go here. So I just wanted to say again that we are, we've been talking to Chad Montry, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, about his book, The Myth of Silent Spring: Rethinking the Origins of American Environmentalism. Chad, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,